Okay, so we're going to look at Exodus 28 and 29, and we're going to have to do a little prep. We've been having to do a little prep every week, actually, because for us, this particular section in Exodus is a little difficult, a little slow. It's part of chapters 25 to 31, and chapters 25 to 31 are about, does anybody remember, about two things in particular, one thing mainly, but the tabernacle. So it's about the tabernacle and then about the priest's garments, actually, and the priests specifically. This is, even though it's a little slow for us, it's an important part of the Pentateuch. We said that basically from Exodus 25 to Numbers is the beginning of Numbers is about the tabernacle, and it's an important part of Exodus. So we usually would like to end at chapter 14 or so, but this is actually the climax of Exodus, Exodus 25 through 40. And it's an important part of the rest of the Bible, this section. If you think about the themes here, the tabernacle, where else does that theme come up in the Bible? The tabernacle theme, where else does that come up in the Bible? Why is this theme an important one?
Oh,
right, in John chapter 1 talks about that. So Jesus is like tabernacling. So this, the tabernacle helps us understand Jesus. It's actually the story of the whole Bible. So if we fast forward to Revelation, this is where the whole, God's plan to make the whole world like his tabernacle. He's going to dwell with us. So the tabernacle is kind of an important theme. If you're watching a movie, you know, maybe the beginning of the movie will have a little glimpse of a character, and then he becomes the main character later, and the tabernacle is definitely a main character in the Bible, a main part of the Bible. And then priests, what about, where else does that come up in the Bible? Priests. Where are some other places that comes up? Hebrews, yeah, we're going to really need to understand priests to understand the book of Hebrews. Always funny when you get those just Gideon Bibles, which we're really thankful for, but when they're only the New Testament, you're like, whoa, man, you think about how much of the New Testament is impossible to understand without these Old Testament concepts. Like priest, definitely. You're like, what are you talking about? Tabernacle as well. I remember somebody saying something that helped me as I read some of these chapters of Scripture, and that is that in the Old Testament, one of the things God is doing is providing categories for us to understand what he's going to teach us later. So he's providing concepts and categories, almost like a teacher stooping down, you know, to use a flannel graph or something like that to help their students understand a bigger concept. And so in the Old Testament, God is, in his mercy, has orchestrated all of history for us. This is part of why Paul and others were just like so amazed, because they're realizing, man, thousands of years of history, God has set up thousands of years of history so that we can understand certain things about Jesus, and so that we can understand certain things about ourselves and what God is doing through Jesus. And so that means we need to pay attention, especially pay attention to categories like this one, like that of a priest. This is one of the most important concepts, really, in the Old Testament for us to understand even what it means to be a church and to understand the work of Christ. So if you think about the Old Testament in terms of the major players, like what are the most important roles that are presented to us in the Old Testament, you would say, well, prophet, that of king, and that of priest. Those are three important categories, especially when it comes to understanding the work of Christ. Maybe one other category would be wise man, but that's more like a subcategory. But prophet, priest, and king. So priest is really important for us to think about. Even just to understand Jesus, I was reading in my devotions the other day. Sometimes I like to, before I start to read the Bible, I like to think of a call to worship or a call to something that gives me hope as I read the Bible. And this passage came to mind, Hebrews chapter 4, verse 14, where it says, "Since then we have a great high priest who's passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession." And so that doesn't mean much if I don't know what a priest is. So it's kind of like, oh, yay. Oh, I don't have any idea. So that's supposed to be something big. And to understand it, we need to think about what it meant to be a priest. Also us, 1 Peter 2, 9 and 10. What are we? What does it say we are as a church? We are a kingdom of priests. Yeah, a royal nation. So it's a big idea, but like I was saying, it falls a little flat for us when we hear it, because we just don't have much of a concept of priest. And probably when we think of priests, what do you think of when you think of priests? If we're thinking about Exodus now, so your mind might go there. But I would typically think of some Catholic guy dressed up in a funny outfit. So I don't really have much of a concept of priest unless I work at it. And so we're going to work at it. What is a priest? What is the significance of a priest? What do they do? And it takes us a while. God's happy to be patient, and he provides little glimpses of the answer to this question along the way. And so we're going to go back before we even get to Exodus 28 for a minute and think about what we know so far, because this is a big section on priests, but we've already gotten a little help in Genesis and Exodus. So we can start with Adam. Adam might be, I wouldn't quite say that he was a priest, because really priests came into the world as a result of the problem that Adam created. But certainly Adam is a picture of the privilege of being a priest. And so it's like before we get to the priest here in Exodus 28 and then later Jesus, God gives us little, you know, pictures of what it means to be a priest. And definitely Adam, there seems to be some connection between Adam in the garden and the work of the priest in the tabernacle. And you can think about how Moses tries to help you see that by, I don't know if you remember, but Genesis 1 and 2 and Exodus 25 to 31 are written in very similar way. Genesis 1 and Exodus 25 to 31 are written in a really similar way. Like, there's a lot of language in Genesis 1, God, the way he made the world, and then the way he told Moses to make the tabernacle. It's almost like we said, like the play on the stage with the movie in the background, and there's a lot of similarities. And then Genesis 2, when we look at the Garden of Eden, and then we look at the way God describes the tabernacle, there are all kinds of parallels. So there's at least 9 parallels between. So if you look at the Garden of Eden sitting here, like a model of the Garden of Eden, and then you look at the tabernacle, model of the tabernacle here, and you're looking back and forth, you realize, oh, wow, there's a lot of similarities between the Garden of Eden and the tabernacle. So I'm supposed to, in my mind, connect the two of them. For example, it talks about God walking back and forth in the Garden of Eden, God walking back and forth in the tabernacle. When Adam is what we usually think of what God says to Adam to do in the garden as gardening. It says cultivate and keep in some of our translations. But the Hebrew words are actually literally serve and guard. And those words are used to describe the priest's role in the tabernacle. There's cherubs guarding the entrance to the Garden of Eden. And the only other place cherubim are mentioned in the whole Pentateuch is there in the tabernacle. The law, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, God gave his law there in the Garden of Eden. The law was kept in the Ark of the Covenant. So the Garden of Eden, you might think of as like a place in Eden. And it was like the Holy of Holies. But Adam was kicked out and there was a little barrier. So he was still, some would say he's still in Eden, but he's kicked out of the Holy of Holies. There's a barrier around the Garden of Eden. And so there's this big problem. I was talking with Clifton yesterday, maybe to get a sense of this. It's like God built a house on earth for him to live in, which is huge. If you think about the creator of the universe building a house to live in on this planet, and he was going to fill that house up with his glory. And then Adam and Eve in the beginning are able to come into the house and enjoy fellowship with God, you know, a meal with God in a sense, in his house. And yet they get kicked out of the house and they're not allowed. Then there's like a guard at the door who says they can't come back in. Unless, if they try to come back in, they're going to die. And so the big question is, you know, how do we get back in the house? How do we get back into Eden? And as we look at Genesis, we see, okay, this is really a problem because people get further and further away from God, and there's a growing ignorance of God. So even the story of Genesis, I think we said last week, goes from, you know, life in the house of God there with God and ends with death in Egypt, far away from God. And so we see the problem, and we also get some hints of the solution. We have this promise from God. There's going to be a seed. Sacrifice right there at the beginning. Somehow getting back in the house is going to involve sacrifice. And also there's danger because Cain offers up his sacrifice, and he is actually, it's not a good sacrifice. He is, he's judged. So that's the first image. Adam, kind of get a little idea of a priest. Second image is maybe the very first clear mention of priest in the Bible. Can anybody think of the very first clear mention of priest in the Bible? The very first priest that shows up. Yeah, so he's not even a Jewish priest. Melchizedek in Genesis chapter 14. And you remember this kind of a weird story. Genesis 12, Abraham's the solution to the problem of the world. Genesis 13, Lot separates from Abram, and what happens to Lot? He gets in trouble. He gets captured in chapter 14. Genesis 14, there's like this war between all these kings, and these certain kings are just winning and battling, and they're these massive, awesome soldiers, and they capture Lot, and then Abram goes to war with these kings that have won these wars, and he wins. And it's amazing. Abram conquers them. And then after that, Melchizedek comes, and another king, the king of Sodom, come to Abram after he's won this great battle. And first comes Melchizedek, and it says that he's a king, and then it says that he's a priest. And so you have a king-priest, and he is a priest of the Most High God, which is really interesting. You kind of wonder, where did he come from? And specifically came from Jerusalem. So you have a king who is also a priest of the Most High God from Jerusalem. And when he comes, he has a meal with Abram. He gives him bread and wine. So he's a king priest coming to Abraham and giving to Abraham. And then he blesses Abraham, which is really almost shocking because Abraham's supposed to be the one who brings blessing to the entire world. And yet here's this king priest from Jerusalem who's coming and blessing Abraham, and Abraham gives a tenth of everything to him. And then the king of Sodom comes, and he takes, basically. But Abraham has a very different reaction to the king of Sodom. So there's just this picture, and it's really later going to be explained in the Bible in Hebrews, but we're not there yet. But it's just like this glimpse of a different, almost a different source of blessing. But you get this idea of like blessing coming from a king priest from Jerusalem. So it helps me to think of the Bible like this massive symphony. And at the beginning of a symphony, I wish I knew more about music, but I can just imagine it working this way. I don't know if it really does. But in my little world where this illustration works, it works this way. But like at the beginning of a symphony, I can imagine them playing certain notes and then leaving those notes for a long time until later, towards the climax of the symphony, the composer brings those notes back in. And if you're really good at music, you're like, whoa, that's where that came from. It wasn't random. And so here's this little picture at the beginning of God's symphony of this king priest from Jerusalem who's bringing blessing to Israel, who's going to bring blessing to the entire world. And then all of a sudden he's gone out of the picture until like later Jesus, you're like, oh, wow, okay. this is who we're supposed to be looking for. But Adam, Melchizedek. Then there's a third image of a priest to help us understand, a third picture to help us understand the work of a priest, and that's actually Aaron. And that might be the clearest one for what we're going to be studying, because we know this is where these priests that we're reading about came from. But how did Aaron get started? So we're going to look at Exodus chapter 28. But if you think about, and Aaron is going to play a big role. He's actually going to end up becoming the first high priest. But before we look at the priesthood and Aaron becoming the high priest, it's good to take a step back and think about, okay, how did Aaron really come into play? He becomes this significant figure, and he's going to help us understand what it means to be a priest. But how did he get this job? Like, how did he get started? And so to answer that, we could go back to Exodus chapter 4, verses 13 to 17. And you remember, this is where God is asking Moses to do something. He's come to Moses. He's giving Moses this tremendous privilege. And Moses is basically saying, God, no, I really don't want to do it. And finally, God gets angry. And this is the first time we really see anger like this. When it comes to the flood, I think it says God's greed. But here we have the anger of the Lord. And Moses says, verse 13, "Oh, my Lord, please send someone else." Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. And it's just so interesting. If that is the first mention of anger, I want to know, but I'm pretty sure it is. If that's the first mention of God's anger, he's angry here because he wants to save his people, and Moses is refusing. Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses, and he said, "Is there not Aaron, your brother, the Levite? I know that he can speak well. Behold, he's coming out to meet you, and when he sees you, he'll be glad in his heart. You shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth and with his mouth, and will teach you both what to do. He shall speak for you to the people, and he shall be your mouth, and you shall be as God to him. And then take in your hand the staff with which you shall do the signs." So what do we see here? It doesn't say priest in this at this point, but he's brought into the story, Aaron. Why? Why does he start to have this big role? Yeah, because of Moses' unbelief. And so that's not a great sign. And then what does God say about Moses? Is there not Aaron, your brother, the Levite? So it's kind of interesting that God, brings up he's a Levite here. I think that's because he's just connecting Aaron to the Levitical priesthood. So the Levites are going to have this massive role in the tabernacle. So this is our first big introduction to Aaron, and it's significant. Somebody explains it like this. Aaron's first introduction into the story comes in conjunction with Yahweh's burning anger and as a concession for Moses' apparent faithless resistance to Yahweh's instructions. Moses was punished for his unwillingness to accept Yahweh's commission and was likewise denied the honor that would come with it. The glory of fulfilling the task did not belong to Moses alone, but was shared in part by his brother Aaron. The author seems to be portraying the scenario as gradually deviating from what Yahweh initially envisaged or pictured, or what the ideal scenario might have been had Moses not responded with such resistance. So this is kind of like a replay, someone said, of Adam's failure in the garden. Once again, God's chosen representative is failing to fulfill his calling, even in front of a magnificent tree brimming with God's own life and presence. So there's a tree. Moses fails his first test, which is to trust God. Moses' actions, actually, as we read through Exodus 3 through 7, Moses and Aaron, they continually deviate from God's direction. So God tells Moses, this is what I want you to do with Aaron. And they're supposed to gather the elders of Israel. They do that. But then he's to go to Pharaoh with the elders of Israel. And he doesn't do that. Aaron ends up going. Then when they speak to Pharaoh, they don't say exactly what God told them to say. They add a mention. They add something. And then they don't perform any signs and wonders the first time they go to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh increases the brick quota. And then from the start, when we are going to look at Aaron doing his job as a priest, he fails. So basically what we have is this great opportunity. We're getting this Aaron's going to be this priest who gets to go back into God's house in a sense. But we're already not off to a great start. So we kind of have like a question about these priests. But we're just trying to, okay, we're going to, priests is a big category. And so we're going to look at Exodus 28 and 29. We're just prepping by saying, okay, here are a couple little pictures of priest that we get in the Bible. We get Adam getting to go into God's house, and he's kicked out. And then we get Melchizedek, this royal king priest from Jerusalem who blesses Abraham. And then we get Aaron, and at the beginning of Aaron's life here, we're like, oh man, God's building, basically in the tabernacle. I was just struck this week how big a moment the tabernacle is, because it's like, God's like, for after thousands of years, he's like, okay, I'm going to build a house back on the planet. You know, the Garden of Eden, God's house, I'm going to live there. The tabernacle is called God's dwelling. God's like, okay, I'm going to rebuild my house, and I'm going to move back in. And so the priest is going to get to be Adam. He's going to get to go back into, finally, after all these years out of the Garden of Eden, somebody gets to go back into the house. God unlocks the door. It's only once a year. And there's only one guy, ultimately, who gets to go back into the house. But he gets to go back into God's house for one day. But that's a pretty big moment. And yet, at the same time, we kind of have a little questions as we look at Aaron, because he's coming into play because Moses isn't believing, and they're not quite doing what God called them to do.
Didn't Aaron say, why me?
Yeah.
Did he ever say that?
I don't know, yeah.
Why me?
Yeah, hey, and Moses is like, because I didn't believe. It wasn't supposed to be you, buddy. Enjoy the moment. The next talk of priests is Exodus 19. Israel is supposed to be a kingdom of priests. And again, we're like, what does that mean? We know it has something to do with the presence of God, blessing from God, and some idea of sacrifice, but we don't know too much. And then there's a fourth picture that can kind of help us, and we're almost there. We're almost to Exodus 28, I promise here. But the fourth picture that maybe helps us some more is Moses, actually. So I bring up Moses because there's a really interesting thing about how the Bible works that I usually have missed in the past. But this is the way the Bible works in general, but it definitely works this way with Moses in particular. And part of how the Bible works is you have one character who comes onto the scene, and you're watching him do things, and then the movie keeps going on, and you find another character, and you're like, I think I saw this part of the movie before, but it's a little different, and you realize, oh, wow, this later character repeats what I saw happen in the earlier character's life. And so that earlier character helps me understand the later character. And that's true with Moses and Israel. So Moses, what happens to Moses happens to Israel later. So if you think about Moses' life, Exodus starts with Moses being rescued by God. He's this son who's in trouble because the Pharaoh wants to kill him. And he's placed in water, and he's rescued from the water. Through the water, and Miriam, his sister, is there watching as it's happening, and God delivers him, and Pharaoh ends up paying for Moses' upbringing. And so then you think about Israel later. Israel's the son of God. Israel's in trouble. How are they rescued? They're rescued through water. As they're rescued, Miriam is there watching. She actually sings this huge song, and they plunder the Egyptians. The Pharaoh pays for them, and all of Egypt basically pays for them to leave. That's how they're even able to build this tabernacle and have all this gold and stuff. And then even if you think about the way they're rescued, there's this weird story about Moses and God comes to him, and you know, he's about to kill him, and his wife, like, you know, does something gross and puts blood at his feet. And so Moses has a kind of Passover, basically. His son, there's blood from his son that enables him to survive. And then Israel later is going to be rescued through blood, through a substitute. So, and then, of course, there's also, where has Moses been before he rescued Israel? He's been in the wilderness for 40 years. And that changes when he meets with God at the mountain. This little tiny, this tree that's burning and is a holy place. And Israel's going to spend 40 years in the wilderness. And they're going to meet with God at the mountain with this fire and this holy, special holy place. So I don't know if this is like the strongest parallel, but there are at least echoes that get us thinking as we look at Moses. You know, we see Israel. And what makes that connection even stronger is later in the Bible, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, Paul says that Israel was baptized into Moses, which is really weird. You never hear of anything. Usually it's about being baptized into Christ. So this is really powerful for him to say Israel was rescued as they were baptized into Moses. And so that's a shocking thing for Paul to say. But basically he's saying, even though it's hard for us to grasp all of it, but he's saying Israel, it was connected with Moses. Israel was identified with Moses. And I bring that up, all that up, that connection, because Moses gives us a little picture of what it means to be a priest and what it means for Israel to be a kingdom of priests, especially in Exodus 19 through 24. Because you remember we read Exodus 19 to 24. They're out Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai, the tabernacle is a portable Mount Sinai. So it's like what happened at the at Mount Sinai, God gives a little portable version of it for them to take with them into the promised land. And so what is happening at Mount, and you know, there's Mount Sinai is divided up into three sections, just like the tabernacle. So there's all kinds of connections between Mount Sinai and the tabernacle. But what happens at Mount Sinai, somebody said it like this. They said, when you read Exodus 19 to 24, one of the hardest things to figure out is where is Moses? Because it's like he's like here, then he's up there, then he's here, then he's up there. And throughout you're like, is Moses with the people right now or is he up with God? And there's a reason for that. Moses keeps going up and down the mountain, up and down the mountain, ascending and descending the mountain. And basically what's happening is God comes in his glory and Moses ascends to God. And when he ascends to God, he's representing the people to God. And when he descends from being with God, he's representing God to the people. And so Moses is the one who enables Israel to have a relationship with God. And really, he's a picture of a priest. The priest's job is to represent God to the people and the people to God. And so the climax of it all is, of that section, is Exodus 24. And now we're almost there. We're so close. Exodus 24, 15 to 18, it says, then Moses went up on the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain. The glory of the Lord dwelt on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it six days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. Now the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a devouring fire on the top of the mountain in the sight of the people of Israel. And Moses entered the cloud and went up on the mountain, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. So this is just, it's like, it's almost too much. So, you know, this, if we think about it, thousands of years since the Garden of Eden, God's big plan for the Garden of Eden, seventh day, rest, enjoyment, God with his people, experiencing them experiencing his presence forever. And here on the seventh day, you know, Moses is up 6 days waiting. And on the seventh day, God opens the door and he's like, come into my home, you know. And you watch, after all these years, you watch Adam, in a sense, get to go back in. And so this is really big. Somebody puts it like this. This is a climactic point. Moses becomes a picture of the human image of God, resting with God, calling back to the story of creation as he ascends into the heights of the mountain on the seventh day. No wonder he starts glowing with God's glory. And then for 40 days and 40 nights, God speaks to Moses in seven distinct sections regarding instructions for the tabernacle. So this is kind of like a recreation thing going on here. And at the center of these instructions is a long speech detailing the clothing of the priest. These clothes are only to be worn when the priests are fulfilling their Adam and Eve roles inside the micro Eden, the tabernacle, which is the part we want to read together now, Exodus chapter 28. And this is God. He's describes a little bit of the building of the tabernacle, and now he's going to describe how he wants the priests to be dressed as they go into the tabernacle. And maybe, Marty, you could just read verse 1.
"Then bring near to you Aaron, your brother, and his sons with him from among the people of Israel to serve me as priests, Aaron and Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar."
So this is the first calling of Aaron to the role of priest. And now think about this for a minute. What is happening on the ground as Moses is up on the mountain receiving these instructions about Aaron as priest? We're going to see it in a few chapters.
Aaron's priesting.
Aaron's priesting in a terrible, terrible way. Yeah, so, man, God is so patient. He is calling Aaron to be a priest as Aaron is doing the worst work of priest ever on the ground. And it's also a little scary about Israel's priests. You know, where are they going to end up taking Israel? But now he starts talking about specific instructions, and he begins with how Aaron is to be dressed, which is going to seem really long to us, but is significant. And it's one way we know it's significant is because there's not a lot of talk about clothes in the Pentateuch. So the only other place I can think much about clothes would be Adam and Eve, the first time they get clothes, and then Joseph with his special jacket, and now here. So it's not like God is just like a fashion designer who's like, oh, let me talk about this. But so when there's a lot of talk about two chapters on clothes, or at least one long chapter on clothes, it's like, okay, this is a big big moment. And also, you know, whether we're not, we kind of get funny because some of us at least, we sort of minimize the importance of rituals. We're all relaxed, but like clothes do matter. We wear certain clothes at certain times. You know, even me coming today wearing a t-shirt, I feel funny wearing a t-shirt. I was thinking walking out of the house, I'm not used to teaching in a t-shirt. And that's just me being weird. But at the same time, it's also because clothes do represent, you wear certain clothes certain places at certain times. We even still wear black when we go to funerals. When you see somebody coming in dressed up in a, he has a stethoscope, he's dressed up in all, in like one of those funny outfits, scrubs, you're like, okay, you know, you don't just wear that around. If you see somebody wearing that around and you're like, hey, what's your job? He's like, I'm a real estate agent. You're like, you're a real estate agent. Why are you wearing scrubs? Because scrubs, we know clothes represent something. So as we read this, it is long to us, but it does, we even know that clothes represent something. So we're kind of asking what are these clothes supposed to represent? And so how about verses 2 through 5, Bay? Okay, so God is building his house back here on earth, and these are the men that are going to get to go in and represent the people to him and him to the people. But before they go in, they don't just go in every, any outfit. God wants to get them ready to go in by giving them certain garments. Now, specifically, who does the first verse say the garment is for?
For Aaron, your brother.
Yes, okay. So later then it talks about making garments for the sons. And what we're going to see is the high priest and the priests were dressed a little differently. But what kind of garments? What does it say about these garments?
Holy garments.
Holy garments. So it's kind of funny to think of holy clothes. But clothes that are set apart. And what is the purpose of them? What does he want to do with these clothes?
For glory and for beauty.
Yeah, so that's kind of interesting. Way to describe the purpose of an outfit, but he's saying he wants these guys to look glorious and to look beautiful. And then how are these garments to be made?
With skill.
Yes, and then what is God actually going to do to make sure that they're made with skill? Or what has he done to make sure that they're filled with skill? Or that they're done, made with skill.
Fill people with the spirit of skill.
Yes, yeah. So, just because we tend to, overlook things, I just wanted us to notice that there's a lot here that Moses is trying to get us to look at these clothes. Because he's like, they're holy. supposed to set these people apart as just shining, in a sense, glorious and beautiful. And God is actually filling people with a spirit of skill, whatever that means, to make these clothes. And then what do these garments do? So the garments somehow set Aaron apart for priesthood. So these clothes are really connected to what it meant for Aaron to be a priest. The clothes consecrate him, set him apart as special to be a priest. And then God is really specific about the colors as well. He talks about all the pieces he's going to describe later. But then he's really specific about the colors. And why do you think he's specific about those colors? Probably hard for us to know too much, but those are like royal kinds of colors. It reminds me, one time I was on an airplane and somebody thought they had a vision and they're like, you were dressed in purple and that's the color of royalty. And so, that person was crazy, but this, this is, they did get that from, they did get, yeah, but flattery, yeah. Why did they ask me for money afterwards? I don't know. that part was true. That purple and gold and blue and scarlet are colors of royalty and glory. So if we take this picture back to the Garden of Eden, we get a sort of this image of Aaron like a new Adam, and God is glorifying him so he can serve in his presence. And then the story continues. We're at verse 6 now. Yeah, I'll just start with verse 6.
And they shall make the ephod of gold.
Okay, stop there. Ephod of gold. Because what's an ephod? Basically, it's like an apron or an undershirt that was going to be made of different colors on which they were going to attach something called the breast piece. Okay, so the ephod of gold. Why don't you read verses 6 through 14? It's a lot, and some words that are hard, but just make them up.
They shall make an ephod of gold, of blue and purple and scarlet yarns, and they shall find twined linen skillfully worked. It shall have two gold pieces attached to the edges so that they are made joined together, and the skillfully woven band on the shirt be made like it and be of one piece with it, of gold, blue, and purple.
You shall set the two stones on the shoulder pieces of ephod as the stones of remembrance for the sons of Israel. And Aaron shall bear their names before the Lord on his two shoulders for remembrance. You shall make settings of gold figlery and two chains of pure gold twisted like cords, and you shall attach the corded chains to the legs.
Okay, so what does this section add as you look at it? Here's a little picture of the outfit. But what are some things this section adds as it describes the garments? Maybe some of you who like clothes more will notice more things than I did. I know when I go into a mall to look at clothes, I'm like, but somehow some people can be like, this is amazing. Did you notice? This one's worth noticing. Just mention one or two things that you see there that doesn't have to be anything profound.
Two shoulder pieces.
You like clothes.
Yes. Two shoulder pieces. There's stones, right? Does it mention any particular stone?
Onyx.
That might be one of those places where you're like, have I heard the word onyx before? Not in my everyday life. But you know the other place you hear about onyx? Genesis chapter 2. So, and then the other place you hear about it is Ezekiel chapter 28, which also talks about the Garden of Eden. And then the other place you hear about it is Revelation 21, where you hear about the new Jerusalem. So it's definitely making
beautiful, right?
Yeah, beautiful, and making the connection between these places. And what was the purpose? What's that?
Onyx is a black stone.
Is it? Yeah, you just took me to a new place. I don't know. Yeah, it's so funny how sometimes our minds can be so lazy. So, like, I hear about jewels, and I'm like, I know a ruby's red. That's about what I got. And a diamond is shiny. Yeah. What's the purpose of these stones?
Stones of remembrance.
Stones of remembrance. And so what does that tell you about the job of a priest? Oh, yeah. Also, remember, bear their names, carry their names. We talked about that when we were back in the Ten Commandments, where it talks about, it's the same language for don't take the name of the Lord in vain. It's literally the same word. Don't carry the name of the Lord emptily. And so here the priest is carrying the names of Israel before the Lord, in a sense to remind God of Israel. So he's bringing, he's got Israel on him as he enters into God's house. So it's kind of, I guess it's kind of like somebody coming into your house with pictures of your whole family, you know, like this big shirt with your whole family members on them. And then he continues. What's the next, verse 15? But we'll just start read that first phrase for a second.
You shall make a breastpiece of judgment.
Yeah, so breastpiece is a little, maybe confusing because I think armor, but it's not armor. One translator puts it like this: a breastpiece of judgment should not be understood as a breastplate. The meaning is uncertain, but it was a kind of covering for the chest, which was worn by the high priest. It was made from a piece of square cloth, and it was formed into a pouch where they kept something called the Urim and Thummim. So when you read the Bible, there are definitely places, parts of the Bible, where you're like, I don't know what it's talking about. So Urim and Thummim, is one of those places. Something's going on with the Urim and Thummim that the Bible just, it's like you're watching a movie and it comes across real quick. You're like, what? What just happened? And there's not a ton of explanation. But basically, they would use the Urim and Thummim to make decisions. And so judgment here means determining God's will. So it's like a breast piece of determining God's will with the Urim and Thummim in there. A pouch of judgment is one translation. One translation has it, breast piece for the high priest to use in learning what God wants his people to do. But anyway, now we can just read the rest.
In the style of the ephod, he shall make it. Gold, blue, and purple, and scarlet yarns, and fine twine linen shall he make it. It shall be square and doubled, a span its length, and a span its breadth. He shall set in it four rows of stone. A row of sardius, topaz, and carbuncle shall be the first row, and the second row an emerald, a sapphire, and a diamond, and the third row a jacinth, fourth row a beryl, an onyx, and a jasper. They shall be set in gold filigree. There shall be 12 stones with their names according to the names of the sons of Israel. They shall be like signets, each engraved with its name for the 12 tribes. You shall make for the breastpiece twisted chains like cords of pure gold. And you shall make for the breastpiece two rings of gold and put the two rings on the two edges of the breastpiece. You shall put the two cords of gold and the two rings on the edges. Ends of the two points you shall attach to the two settings of filigree, and so attach it in front to the shoulder pieces of the ephod. You shall make two rings of gold and put them at the two ends of the breastpiece, on its inside edge next to the ephod. And you shall make two rings of gold and attach them front to the lower part of the two shoulder pieces of the ephod, at its seam above the skillfully woven band of the ephod. And they shall bind the breastpiece by its rings to the rings of the ephod with a lace of blue, so that it may lie on the skillfully woven band of the ephod, so that the breastpiece shall not come loose from the ephod. So Aaron shall bear the names of the sons of Israel and the breastpiece of judgment on his heart when he goes into the holy place, to bring them to regular remembrance before the Lord. And in the breastpiece of judgment they shall put the Urim and the Thummim, and they shall be on Aaron.
Right, so this is what Aaron is supposed to be wearing almost all the time. And what's the purpose here? What is he doing? Kind of brings it at the end. He sort of brings it together.
Remembrance before the Lord?
Yeah. Basically, he's bringing the people before God, and he's looking for direction from God. I don't know if this is actually a good application, but when I read this, it at least it sort of confronts me, because there's a lot of stuff in life that doesn't always feel spiritual to me, you know? And I'm like, oh, it's just, am I wasting time? But it's just interesting to watch God stoop down to talk about, okay, this is how you need to make the breastpiece so that the gold rings can go into it. And so if God isn't afraid to stoop down to deal with details like that, probably I shouldn't think they're as unspiritual as I sometimes do. But let's keep reading. We're almost through here. We won't get through everything. But what verse are we on?
31,
yeah, go for it.
Shall make the robe of the ephod all of blue. It shall have an opening for the head in the middle of it, with a woven binding around the opening, like an opening in the garment, so that it may not tear. On its hem you shall make pomegranates of blue and purple and scarlet yarns. Around its hems for bells of gold between them, and a golden bell and a pomegranate, and a golden bell and a pomegranate around the hem of the blue. And it shall be of Aaron when he ministers, and sounds shall be heard when he goes into the holy place before the Lord. Comes out so that he does not die.
Wow. Let's just go all the way down to the end.
Okay. You shall make a plate of pure gold and engrave on it, like the engraving of a signet, holy to the Lord. And you shall fasten it on the turban by a cord of blue. It shall be on the front of the turban. It shall be on Aaron's forehead, and Aaron shall bear any guilt from the holy things that the people of Israel consecrate as their holy gifts. it shall regularly be on his forehead, that they may be accepted before the Lord. He shall weave the coat in checkered work of fine linen, and he shall make a turban of fine linen, and he shall make a sash embroidered with needlework. For Aaron's sons you shall make coats and sashes and caps. You shall make them for glory and beauty. And you shall put them on Aaron your brother, and on his sons with him, and shall anoint them and ordain them and consecrate them, that they may serve me as priests. You shall make for them linen undergarments to cover their naked flesh. They shall reach from the hips to the thighs, and they shall be on Aaron and on his sons when they go into the tent of meeting, or when they come near the altar to minister in the holy place, lest they bear guilt and die. This shall be a statute forever for him and his offering after him.
So it's awesome privilege to get to go into God's house, but it's a little scary. We already see that. But just real quickly, the priests are, they belong to God. They're holy to the Lord. They got God's name on their forehead and God's people's names on their heart. And so they represent the people to God and God to the people. Now, just real quickly, so quickly, I didn't realize this. Two things, but first thing is that this outfit that we read about Aaron wearing, he wears it almost all the time except for one day of the year. And the one day of the year that he doesn't wear it is actually in Leviticus 16 when he goes into the Holy of Holies. So he gets to go into the Holy of Holies one time on the Day of Atonement, and that's the only day he doesn't wear this whole outfit that sets him apart as high priest. He wears it every other day when people can see him out doing his thing and when he goes into the holy place. But on the Day of Atonement, he wears the same thing that all the other priests wear. And so one person explains it like this. Curiously, Aaron was not to wear the most elaborate of his official vestments when it would seem most appropriate to do so while entering the most holy place. When did he wear this outfit then? He wore them only when performing regular sacrifices and maintaining service in the holy place, implying that his representation of Israel to God pertained to the sacrificial system. He did not bear the names of the sons of Israel into the most holy place. When he appeared in the most holy place, he had to come humbly without status or pretense, and in so doing symbolize Israel's undeserved access to Yahweh's presence. He does, however, wear his turban with its inscription. Most importantly, Aaron's diadem signified what was true of the entire nation, namely that they were holy, belonging to Yahweh. On that basis, he appealed to Yahweh for forgiveness of their sins. And then the second thing, again, so quickly, is that there's actually a correspondence between the tabernacle and Aaron's outfit. So in a sense, the way Aaron's outfit is made and described, it's almost like he's representing the tabernacle turned inside out. There was linen on the inside, breastplate corresponding to the most holy place on the outside. But on the Day of Atonement, Aaron wears clothing that corresponds not to the most holy place, but to the courtyard. It was like he was in the holy place. He was bringing the courtyard into the, on the Day of Atonement, bringing the courtyard into the Holy of Holies. So that's kind of cool. I would read you the whole quote, but we're out of time. But that actually, we didn't get through as much as I thought we would. Yeah. All that time on clothes. I don't think I've ever talked about clothes that long in my life. But yes, we're working together. It's like we're looking at a beautiful painting of what God's doing in the universe. And sometimes it takes work as we look at one part of that painting to see the artist's skill. But as we look at that one part of the painting, the goal is that we can step back later and see the big picture and appreciate it better. So even as we think about the priest and what he's wore, the goal ultimately is for us to appreciate what God's doing in us. We get to be priests, and we're clothed in something very beautiful, which is the righteousness of Christ. And we're also looking to our great high priest. We have a much greater high priest than Aaron, Jesus, who always does what God wants. But thanks, guys. Isaiah, will you close us with a word of prayer?